This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Last Punisher, a SEAL Team 3 sniper's true account of the Battle of Ramadi. By Kevin Lace, with Ethan E. Rock and Lindsay Lace. Narrated by Timothy Phillips. Chapter 7. Mass Casualties. War is a game that is played with a smile. If you can't smile, grin. If you can't grin, keep out of the way till you can. Winston Churchill. My wife Lindsay told me a story about three Vietnam veterans who came to speak to her History of Air Power class when she was studying history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. For 45 minutes, they relayed everything they could remember about being grunts in Nam to a lecture hall of 200 attentive 19 and 20-year-olds. I saw some terrible things, one of the older men recalled. But when the sun came up and I'd see those little Vietnamese women walking through the rice paddies, their sedge hats the only things visible, just gliding through the rice. It was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It was fucking beautiful, man. I didn't have any beautiful moments like that in Ramadi. I told Lindsay as much, and she nodded and smiled sadly. Then she said, "Good." "What do you mean?" I asked. "The way he said it," she answered, her voice breaking. "It was the saddest thing I ever heard." Camp Ramadi, early May, 2006. I was eating in the chow hall on Camp Ramadi when an army medic rushed in yelling urgently, "We need litter bearers. We've got vehicles coming in. Triple stack IED. Lots of casualties." I looked at Johnny Guy and the other SEALs at the table. Without a word, we dropped our forks and rushed outside. The insurgents had rigged several 155mm artillery shells together and detonated them when a small convoy of Marines entered the blast zone. It was a massive explosion. Guy approached the medic in charge and told him Johnny and I were special operations medics. The medic was glad to have us there. I had heard the IED detonations in the distance many times before, and I always thought about the death and destruction they wrought. Seeing the carnage firsthand was a completely different level of grim reality. You can push it further back in your mind until you cross the barrier between hearing or reading about the casualties and actually seeing them up close. The image of those American Marines maimed or dying at the hands of cowards filled me with rage. I wanted to do something about it. I wanted to strike back. I would get my chance soon enough. Charlie Med was just a quick run from the chow hall, and we booked it as fast as we could. Initially, we went to the vehicle staging area where the casualties would be delivered, but after we were identified as combat medics, we were ushered inside. "We're probably going to have more casualties than initially expected," said an army medic. He walked briskly through the hectic scene inside, indicating we should follow him. "We're going to need you each to run your own bed. I can give you each three or four medics to help you out. Can you handle your own patients?" "Roger that," we replied. He nodded quickly and left us at a pair of empty beds. I looked around at the scene beyond my bed, which looked like a modern-day MASH episode. Around me, various medical personnel scurried in preparation for the incoming casualties. Crash carts, EKG monitors, IV fluids, and solar blankets were being gathered and distributed. The medics assigned to me came and stood by, waiting for the action they were unfortunately accustomed to. They were young, but they knew what they were doing. I felt anxiety as the casualties started coming in. The blast had burned off some of their camis. There was so much blood. "I don't know if I'm ready for this," I thought, nervously eyeing the other medics. We had trained for mass casualty scenarios at the 18D combat medic course, but it's different in real life. I was about to attempt to stabilize a person, a uniformed American, not a goat. I hadn't felt this level of tension on any of the ops I'd gone on. Treating someone who's been blown up and is fighting for his life is a heavy load to carry. You know that person's survival depends almost completely on you. They need you to make exactly the right decisions, and you have to wrestle with a flurry of thoughts and emotions while trying to stay calm and focused enough to save them. It's difficult to convey the amount of pressure that comes with that feeling. ABC, I kept repeating to myself. Airway, breathing, circulation. There was an atmosphere of organized chaos as beds filled around us. When I heard the announcement that all casualties were accounted for, I realized I would not have to run my own bed. I should have been relieved, but I felt frustrated by my own helplessness. I didn't want to sit idly by. I looked over at the bed closest to me. The doc stood at its head, assessing a young Marine laid out on his back. A couple of privates worked quickly on either side of him, cutting off camis, checking vitals, taking orders. I stepped up assertively to the doc's side. "Sir, I'm an 18D medic," I said quietly. "Can I be of any assistance?" He glanced at me quickly before returning his attention to the pen light he was using to check the Marine's pupils. "Start an IV in his right leg," he answered. My anxiety melted away as my hands found their purpose. I worked efficiently on the Marine, who appeared to have suffered a blast injury to the head. He wasn't conscious. The intracranial pressure that results from such an injury meant this Marine needed to be flown out of Ramadi immediately. Even if he got to Germany, where all serious casualties were flown for treatment, I didn't like his chances. I could tell the doc didn't either. I felt a sudden surge of rage as we packaged up the young Marine and ran him out to the awaiting helo. He was blonde, ashen, and groaning. I noticed his recently cut hair shaved in a fresh, high and tight. He looked no older than 18 or 19, about my youngest brother's age. I felt the urge to curse aloud as I looked at his pupils, one constricted and the other ominously dilated. Basal skull fracture. Not good. The rotor wash of the UH-60 helo blew dust into the tent as we lifted the young man up and ran to the helo pad. A quiet calm washed over me as we passed him to the flight surgeon and crew. There was nothing more we could do for him. He was in their hands. I ducked and ran back outside the radius of the rotors. As the 60 lifted and flew off, I stood there in silence. I thought about the Marine. I wasn't likely to ever learn his fate. As Americans, we fight together. One team, one fight. I turned around and looked out over the city, my jaw clenched. I felt like a hammer, ready to smash every Muj in Ramadi. An hour later, Johnny, Guy, and I left Charlie Med in a somber silence. I stomped heavily through the moondust back toward the chow hall, eager to return to the order of my little tent. My SAW, my M4, my MK11, those things made sense to me. But a dying Marine, not even as old as I was? I couldn't rationalize what the Muj were doing with those bombs in Ramadi's streets. I wanted to stand up and fight with the enemy so bad I could taste it. A week or two after I worked triage for the IED attack, we got another mission to roll up a bomb maker in southwest Ramadi. A few weeks in country, and I was settling into a battle rhythm. We had about 15 ops behind us and plenty more ahead. My combat mindset was evolving. War, like anything else, is a routine, a matter of muscle memory. Get an op, prepare, execute. Anxiety became less of a factor. Hatred for the enemy and his cowardly tactics grew. We were all amped to go after another bomb maker and hopefully have an impact on deterring the IED threat. The area where we headed into had a high concentration of insurgent activity, and nobody had ever pushed through and cleared it. Our target was a compound with a cluster of homes, which we were to clear one by one. It was another early morning op. We almost always operated under the cover of darkness. With our night vision capabilities, we owned the night. Unless they were planting bombs, the Muj mostly operated in daylight, when they could blend in with the local Iraqis. We launched later than usual, leaving around 3 in the morning, which meant we'd be operating in daylight within a few hours. For direct action missions, we usually launched no later than 2 a.m., so we could be back before sunup. With our full SEAL platoon and about 12 Jundis, we had about 30 guys. Movement to the objective took approximately 45 minutes. As usual, we established security around the compound, with our vehicles, and foot patrolled up to the main objective. The streets were narrow, with low-hanging wires everywhere. It was only May, but the temperature at night was already in the 90s. As was often the problem, the humidity fogged up my protective lenses and began to screw with the view through my night vision goggles. I decided to stow the Oakleys in a cargo pocket. Chris Kyle led the patrol. Chris had straggled into Iraq a couple weeks late after the main element and had missed our push over to Corregidor. It was good to have him back in the lead. We reached our first target, set in security on the door to the building, and called up the breach team. Bob came up, set a strip charge on the door, and then signaled for us to get to the minimum safe distance. When Bob blew the breach, the deafening blast cued us to assault. The noise and confusion caused by the explosion provided a tactical advantage. Anyone who might be inside is temporarily stunned while we move in with extreme violence of action. Dust and debris filled the air around us as we lurched forward and funneled through the door in standard fashion. We cleared through the entire building with zero resistance. We left some Jundis to detain the women and children on site and to conduct the Sensitive Site Exploitation, SSE phase. Basically, a thorough search to collect as much intel as possible, and move to the next house. The second house was more of the same. We called in the Jundis to search and moved on. In the third house, there was a surprise waiting for us. It was a walled-in structure and a lot tighter space to operate than the previous buildings. We'd been operating for several hours with the same level of intensity we always applied, and I could feel myself wearing down a little as the sun started creeping up toward the horizon. We stacked, breached, and went. The building had two stories, and we cleared all the way through, finding nothing. The last place to clear was the roof. We figured the Mooj had heard us hitting the other houses and were holed up on the roof waiting for us. I expected to rush into a swarm of insurgents, eager to be martyred in a violent last stand on the rooftop. Here we go, I thought, my jaw clenched. Whoever's up there knows we're coming and is ready for us. My heart was racing, adrenaline surging. I got the signal from Jeremy and passed it to Bob. I was ready for hell on the other side of the door. We spilled onto the roof, berserker style, ready to cut down anything in our path. Goats. The entire rooftop was swimming with goats. A meandering horde of gray and white livestock was bleeding lazily in a way that almost felt like taunting, as if the insurgents were pranking us. "What the fuck?" Jeremy said. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I said. "Well, there's something you don't see every day," Bob said. We all just looked at each other and laughed, only in Ramadi. We were all pretty spent and ready to get out of there. Being in bad guy territory in the daylight was never smart. Luke called in the Jundis to search, and we all started gathering whatever intel we could find. We found computer parts, cell phones, a bunch of CDs, and Iraqi dinars, money. The place was rife with all the signs of being a Mooj house, except for the Mooj. We stuffed several trash bags full of the valuable items and headed out to the vehicles. I tossed the trash bag onto the back of Big Zev and was about to hoist myself up when I heard the roar of a diesel engine and the screech of tires in the distance. My hold on Big Zev slackened as I went for my weapon and turned toward the noise. A city bus came screaming around a corner. Our radios came alive with the call, "Mooj bus! Mooj bus! 4 o'clock!" It was barreling toward us like an angry bull. "You've got to be kidding me," I thought. "These dudes are about to get chewed the fuck up." There we were, some of the most highly trained and best equipped warriors in the world, and we were being chased down by a bunch of Mooj who'd just hijacked a scene from Speed. I shook off the sheer absurdity of what was happening and calmly raised my M4 to my shoulder. The bus screeched to a halt about 200 yards out, and several Mooj piled out and ran toward us with AK-47s and RPGs. They may not have been tactical, but they were prepared. "Heads down! Heads down!" Guy yelled from behind Big Zev's 50 above us in the turret. Often stuck in the TOC, Guy loved an opportunity to get his war on, and he didn't hesitate when the opportunity presented itself. We all got low as he trained the gun on the bus and opened up with a vengeance, unleashing a deafening stream of hot metal just a few feet over our heads. When you're behind the 50, the explosive chug-chug-chug rhythm is loud, but the decibel level is tolerable. Being just a few feet below and in front of it is a completely different story. The concussive blasts of each thumb-sized round leaving the barrel at a muzzle velocity of 2,900 feet per second make your head rattle, like someone slamming two frying pans together with your skull in between. To say it's an uncomfortable feeling is a gross understatement. We all stayed low, creeping away from Guy's line of fire and over Big Zev's sidewalls to join in the turkey shoot. Mooj bus had been the only order, and we didn't need another one. It was read and react. Instinctively, we fanned out online and engaged. The whole thing was too absurd to process while it was happening. It reminded me of the scene in Star Wars, when Han Solo takes off running in a kamikaze charge after a few stormtroopers on the Death Star, only to turn a corner into a horde of enemy waiting to blast him. The main difference between that and our scenario was that stormtroopers couldn't hit water if they fell off a boat. SEALs, on the other hand, are not stormtroopers, and even my Jundis could hit a Moosh bus. The 50-gunner from the Humvee opposite Big Zev on the other side of the street unleashed holy hell on the Moosh bus, and I saw pops and sparks and little flames erupting all over it as both our 50-gunners ripped it to shreds with a steady stream of red-hot metal. The guys who made it off the bus didn't get far. I imagined what it must have been like for the Moosh, screeching around the corner, all amped up, chanting, "God is great," ready to surprise and kill some Americans, only to find themselves staring down a platoon of heavily armed SEALs, ready to settle the score through an awesome display of superior American firepower. We were finally getting an outlet for all our built-up aggression. For once, we had a stand-up fight, an incredibly lopsided fight, but a fight nonetheless. Every one of us poured hate into that bus, and the handful of insurgents who managed to get outside just in time to catch a hail of bullets and crumple in a bloody heap. I fired at the bus, at the insurgents, and at anything hostile coming from that doomed vehicle of death. I'd heard the old cliche so many times, like shooting fish in a barrel. Now, I'd seen it firsthand. The barrage lasted about 2 minutes, and when it was done, there was broken glass and carnage all around and inside the smoking bus, now peppered liberally with hundreds of holes, giving it a sponge-like appearance. The call to ceasefire came over the radio, and all of us just sat there for a moment, waiting for anything to move. Nothing did. We looked around at each other, and everyone began to laugh. "Dude, did that just fucking happen?" I said to no one in particular. "That was some Highway of Death shit right there," the legend said. "I don't know what to call it, but it was fucking awesome," Guy said. Bob, who'd been closest to the 50 cal, yelled, "What the fuck'd you say? I can't hear shit." Everybody laughed, and Luke called over the radio, giving the order to move out. The truck rumbled to life as we all sat back on Big Zev's sandbags, smiling with a mixture of satisfaction and incredulity. Riding back to Shark Base in silence, I remembered stories about the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, and how the Iraqi soldiers and Fedayeen fighters would sometimes roll up to the fight in school buses. Moosh buses were apparently a thing in Iraq, a very ill-advised thing. The whole absurd tactic made me think of my favorite passage from George C. Scott's classic opening monologue in Patton. The film was a regular fixture for our platoon in Iraq. We watched it religiously during our downtime and frequently quoted Patton's opening speech to his troops. "Now, we have the finest food and equipment, the best spirit, and the best men in the world. You know, by God, I actually pity those poor bastards we're going up against. By God, I do. We're not just going to shoot the bastards. We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel." Moosh bus, our first bushel. I couldn't help but grin. I preferred it when the mass casualties were on the enemy's side. Saddam Hospital, Ramadi, late June 2006. Throughout the Battle of Ramadi, when wounded Iraqi police officers were taken to Ramadi General Hospital, members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq cut their heads off. The Geneva Conventions stipulate that hospitals may in no circumstances be the object of attack, but shall at all times be respected and protected by the parties to the conflict. The Moosh didn't care much for the laws of war, nor the laws of man. Throughout Ramadi, they were carrying out savage acts of brutality. The enemy we fought literally chained handicapped people to walls and basements, or sawed off the heads of Iraqis who supported coalition forces. And they had been using the 7-story hospital just south of the Euphrates to treat their wounded and to fire on American forces in the area. By late June, the Marines were pushing farther north, and they wanted sniper support for the operations to wrest the hospital from the insurgents and secure the surrounding area. Our mission was to conduct a 48-hour sniper overwatch just north of the hospital. The most direct route to our target was via riverine insertion from the Euphrates. This was a welcome change for us. We're frogmen, after all, and there are no IEDs in the Euphrates. We launched out of Camp Hurricane Point, a marine base butted up in a corner of northwest Ramadi, where the Euphrates meets the Habaniya Canal. The Marines had a small unit riverine craft unit, and we hitched a ride with them to our drop-off point. As I boarded what looked like a big camouflaged banana raft, I wondered, where the fuck are the Navy SWCC boat guys? Aren't they the special riverine unit of surface warfare combatant crafts that are supposed to take me to war? Why are the Marines driving me around? Then again, I didn't complain. I liked working with the Marines. You're a former water taxi, Nick. Hop in there and drive us to the op, I said to EOD Nick, as we watched the boats being loaded into the canal. Fuck you, Dauber, EOD Nick replied. Leave him alone, Dauber, Johnny cut in. He's a tech now. He gets sensitive. We new guys had zero authority over anyone in the platoon, but we made damn sure to give the support guys shit any chance we got. Nick was a good sport and always gave it right back. Go watch Charlie Sheen's Navy SEALs and keep telling yourself you're cool. I've got some work to do. The SWCC guys were always there in the movies, but they apparently forgot to deploy to Iraq with us, so we rode banana rafts with the Marines. The boats had a hard time getting out of Hurricane Point because the Euphrates current was ripping. Eventually, the swirling current gave way to the straining hum of the engines, and we motored into the easterly flow toward our objective. The boats put out only a small wake as we slowly cut the oven-hot air, mosquito-infested and miserably sticky like a Florida swamp in the summer. It was a short 15-minute cruise to our insertion point. I felt like I was in the Mekong Delta. I finally felt like an old-school frogman, coming up out of the water. Check that box. We hurried off and set security, and the boats quickly moved off to do some recon and false insertions. We stayed on the banks motionless, listening to the frogs and getting consistently more pissed off at the mutant mosquitoes that bit us as we sat there pouring sweat. Finally, we got the signal to move. Our target was a compound just 40 yards up from the bank. We planned to use it as a staging point for our recon and eventual assault on the hospital. It had a huge wall around it, and there were three large houses. We sent Squirrel over to the 8-foot wall. Once on top, he discovered an 18-foot drop to the ground on the other side. Oh shit, he muttered before climbing back over. He went back up with a rope, and we waited to climb over one by one. With the whole platoon waiting, I noticed how dead quiet it was. A fat mosquito buzzed up for a hearty drink of hot blood. Talk about terrorists. Squirrel secured the rope and nimbly got up, over, and down the wall. Fucking midgets, I thought. Chris was next and did not move with the same dexterity and spring. A snicker came from someone on security as the old man disappeared from view. Each man slowly but quietly made his trip. We pressed through the open field to the large three-story house on the west side of the compound, lasers lighting up every dark space and open window. We cleared through the three houses as quietly as possible, finding them completely empty. They were three-story structures with about 15 fully furnished rooms in each. Most important, the two outside houses had air conditioning, which meant we were really in the lap of luxury. My squad took up positions in the westernmost house. As we snooped around the house looking for the best spots to set up in, Biggles Guts announced pretty loudly the need to evacuate themselves ASAP. That fucking Chili Mac from the chow hall was a bad choice. I think it's trying to murder me, he whispered to me. I gotta shit. Take your disgusting ass far away from me. I'm setting up here, I said, gesturing to the room I'd picked on the second floor, looking west. Whatever's going on in there sounds heinous. Biggles had a reputation in the platoon as a serial shitter. He liked to leave little surprises in unexpected nooks and crannies of the buildings we operated from. He got a kick out of his self-appointed role as our resident shit bomber. A few minutes after he disappeared, Tony was setting up in the room next to mine when he growled, "What the fuck? What the fuck is that smell?" I laughed hard, knowing Biggles had struck again. He quietly marked his territory right next to where Tony set up, blasting a disgusting Chili Mac turd on the ledge in front of one of the windows. Biggles sat in the corner laughing and said nothing. The mad shitter strikes again. I rolled out my foam mat, which stretched from my head to my thighs. It was about 2 a.m, and I took off my web gear and body armor. We owned the night, and the risk of attack was relatively low. I grabbed a few water bottles from my ruck and set them next to my mat. I pounded one and packed a dip. Then I drained another into my camelback so I'd have a piss bottle when the time came. In order to be effective behind the gun, the less time away from it, the better. The extra bottle prevented a trip to the head mid-hunt. I lay down on my mattress and arranged my trio of bottles strategically, from left to right, dip spitter, water, piss bottle. These are important details. You don't ever want to confuse the wrong bottle in these situations. Dale made that mistake when we first landed in Ramadi. I lay there sucking up the air conditioning while Chris took first watch. We traded time on the gun until the sun came up, sleeping during off hours. By 6, I was back on the gun, watching the rising sun spread out over our sector as the call to prayer stirred the city to life. Critiquing the singing voice of the muezzins at the morning call had become a favorite pastime.
"Is this guy sitting on a pineapple or something?" Chris said. "He's got a voice like a squeaky dog toy."
"Sounds like a drunk guy trying to sing Freddie Mercury at karaoke," I said.
"Good one," Chris said.
Queen was not the legend's flavor of music. Around 8, a loud burst of gunfire snapped us all to attention. I looked for the source and saw about 5 Moosh fighters about 200 yards to the west, popping up and down out of the tall grass and shrubs like a whack-a-mole game, taking pot shots at a marine patrol across the river. They were all dressed in what was apparently the Moosh's standard uniform, Adidas tracksuit pants, sneakers, and a t-shirt or tank top. Most had short hair and ratty beards, and their obvious lack of training and tactical skill was so glaringly awful that it was almost impressive. Not only were they not shooting at us, but they had no idea we were there, which was a very unique and awesome position for us to be in. We'd set the perfect ambush for these guys without even meaning to. They had strolled right into the ideal kill zone. There's a saying, when life hands you lemons, make lemonade. As team guys, when Ramadi hands you a team of Moosh, make dead Moosh. Luke gave the order to hold fire until the 8 guys in our building could set up to engage. We would hit them simultaneously with a wall of lead. I watched them through my scope as Chris grabbed his gun and headed for the roof. All our guys scrambled to get into position quickly. Bob set up next to me with his MK-48. A couple of insurgents shot across the river while the others started setting up a mortar tube. As I waited for everyone to get set, my excitement grew with the thought of dropping the cleaver on these guys' necks. I remember the night on the rooftop when Mark shook me out of my rack to help shoot the Moosh across the river. These guys were about to pay the man in full. It took me a minute or so to get in place, and then Luke gave the command over comms. 3, 2, 1, execute! On the second syllable of execute, I squeezed the remaining slack out of the trigger of my MK-11. I shot a guy in the neck and watched him crumple in a heap. Never underestimate the neck shot. I scanned for a second target and saw the life draining from the remaining fighters as Bob and the other gunners tore them up with a vicious onslaught of machine gun fire, while 40mm golden eggs from Jeremy's M79 grenade launcher erupted loudly in massive dust plumes that swallowed up any life that might have remained. Within about 3 seconds, all 5 Moosh were dead, utterly ruined before they ever knew what hit them. Luke called ceasefire over the radio, and all was quiet for a few seconds. Nothing moved from the dust below. Bob and I looked at each other with knowing smiles. I felt sated, like I'd just drunk my fill after hours of thirst.
"That was fucking awesome," I said. "That might be the coolest thing I've seen yet," Bob replied, "besides the Moosh boss."
I looked out again at the Moosh lying dead. They lay out there all day in the summer heat, rotting. Better them than the Marines. At around 2 in the afternoon, I was lying on my back resting when I heard 5 shots come from the eastern house where the other half of our platoon was set up. There was about a half second in between each shot. Chris and I looked at each other. I got up and walked to the adjacent room.
"What the fuck's going on?" I asked Biff, our secondary comms guy. "Johnny shot some guy who walked inside the compound, but he's not dead. They have to go get him."
"He shot 5 fucking times," I said. "How did he not kill him?"
Jason shrugged. "Asian vision."
"He's a sniper, right?"
"Not today," Biff replied.
Because we actually adhere to the Geneva Conventions and Article 12 requires we treat wounded combatants, Luke sent Johnny and EOD Nick to grab the guy and bring him inside. A couple of other guys and some Jundis provided security while Johnny and Nick ran outside and dragged him into their building. He was an old Iraqi man who had been pushing a wheelbarrow full of wires, bricks, and bomb-making materials. Johnny had been on his M4 watching the guy as he rolled up. He must not have zeroed his EO tech sight, because after 5 shots, Johnny managed to hit him only once in the shoulder and once in the left shin. He'd been using frangible rounds, which are designed to disintegrate when they come in contact with a surface harder than the bullet itself. When they hit flesh and bone, they behave very unpredictably. There was only a tiny hole near the guy's shoulder and not much blood. The bleeding was all internal. The round had taken a hard south turn and then hit some vital organs. Luke, Mark, EOD Nick, and a bunch of Jundees gathered around watching as Johnny tried to save him. Johnny sweated profusely as he stripped the guy's mandress down to find his anatomical landmarks. The guy's trachea started shifting, and Johnny had to do a needle decompression into his lung to try to save him. He sank the needle in, and a small whoosh of air came out when he pulled it. It took Johnny a minute to figure out the round had hit the descending aorta, and there was basically no chance for him. He died a few seconds later, and Johnny just kind of sat there for a few seconds, short of breath and sweating. Everyone was quiet. Then, the opening lines from Kansas's Dust in the Wind broke the silence. "I close my eyes, only for a moment, and the moment's gone," Mark was singing. Team guy humor is dark because war is dark. Sometimes you need a laugh to get your head back in the game. All eyes turned to Mark, and we couldn't help but laugh. "At least your singing's better than Johnny's shooting," EOD Nick said. "Or his corpsman skills," Mark said. "I think you needled him to death, Johnny." Everyone was laughing, but Johnny's somber look showed he was not amused, and he fired back, "Fuck all you guys," while packing up his med bag. Johnny was an excellent medic. He was more pissed about his shot placement than the futile attempt at saving the Mooja's life. "I still gamble better than you, Mark. I'm Asian. It's math, and I can at least count to 11, Johnny replied. Laughter erupted. Everyone stared at the body for a minute, realizing it couldn't just sit there in the middle of the hide site. Luke eventually made the call to put the body in the middle house, the one without air conditioning. Because he had shot the guy, Johnny had to move him again. EOD Nick helped him, and everybody else went back to their positions. The rest of the day was mostly uneventful. We didn't see the target-rich environment we'd been expecting from the Marines' assault on the hospital to our east, which started earlier that day. The head shed had hoped the assault would push a lot of retreating Mooj in our direction and we'd be able to take them out, but it didn't happen that way. The afternoon and evening were slow, and the biggest problem we faced was the need to conserve water for our second day of overwatch. Luke got on the horn and convinced the Marines we could do more good if we moved to the hospital that night. Tony briefed us up on the plan. At midnight, we were going to move to another position inside the hospital and provide sniper overwatches there. The body was coming with us, and Johnny was going to carry him. The Marine leadership had told Luke he needed to clear out the buildings completely, and that included taking the dead Mooj with us and delivering him to the hospital. It really was the best thing to deliver him to the hospital and have a body to match the shooter's statement. Nobody wants an investigation launched when some Iraqi civilian finds a body in a building with a couple of American rounds in it. And it wouldn't be beneath the Mooj to find a way to use it as a propaganda tool. Unfortunately for Johnny, the body had been cooking in the middle house for almost 8 hours. When it got close to launch time, we all consolidated in the eastern house, where I got a good look at the 300-yard area we had to traverse. The 7-story hospital poked up prominently above the other buildings in the city to our south. Beyond our compound gate, there was an open field, stretching about 200 yards to an east-west running road just before the hospital. Right before we moved out, Tony told Johnny to get the dead guy and get ready to move. I swear I could hear the sound of Johnny's spirit breaking as he walked away to carry his prize. Under the cover of darkness, we left the house and moved tactically through the compound's gate, with the first couple of guys pressing out left and right to set a footprint and hold security while the rest of the element rolled through. Johnny is a small guy, and on top of his usual combat load, which includes sniper rifle and med bag, he had to heave the rotting Mooj onto his shoulder and was trying to run with him. The body was forcing Johnny's helmet down over his eyes. The poor guy couldn't see anything and was exhausted before we even got out of the gate. Ned, our third officer, gave Johnny a hand, and they made the mad dash through the field toward the hospital. I saw them in the middle of the platoon formation, awkwardly lugging the body, struggling to hold on to the guy's man dress while their guns flapped all around. "Dauber, give us a hand," Ned said. "Fuck no," I said. "I didn't shoot that guy. I don't want anything to do with that. I'm not carrying that dirty Mooj." When the patrol made it to the road, they stopped and put him down. 200 yards carrying almost 200 pounds of dead weight was no joke, and as they sat there panting next to the Mooj, I thought about Weekend at Bernie's and almost laughed. The only thing missing was a pair of sunglasses for the dead guy. I know it's not really funny, but sometimes you just have to give in or go nuts. We set security and pressed across the road, the dead guy tormenting Johnny and Ned the entire time. When we reached the hospital's perimeter, Johnny and Ned ran into yet another fuck-my-life moment. A wrought iron fence surrounded the hospital, big spear-like spikes protruding about 8 or 9 feet high. We all had to get up and over that, and so did Desert Bernie. After a few of us got over, Johnny and Ned made a valiant heave, hoisting Bernie up and over first, only to have his man dress get caught on the fence. The fence pulled Bernie's dress over his head like a hockey player in a fight, and as he fell awkwardly against the fence on the other side, Bernie let out a death fart. That was the moment I learned that a dead body farting is one of the most disgusting things you can ever smell, especially when it's a dead body that's been cooked for 8 hours in a house with no AC in 130-degree heat. The smell was absolutely vile. I looked at Johnny and could tell it was almost too much for him. After shooting this guy, trying to save him, shepherding him across a few hundred yards of moosh country, and then inhaling his death fart at close range, Johnny looked like he was ready to blow chunks. But he didn't. He held it together like a frogman should. "Want some Copenhagen?" I said. He flicked me the bird. We had done our duty with Bernie. We left him at the front door of the hospital and headed inside. The Marines said they needed help in the east wing, so we moved cautiously toward it. Even though the Marines had already cleared the building, we wanted to be careful. The hospital was huge, and the Marines had found a bunch of areas where the Moosh had been treating their people. We pressed into the east wing and set in our hide sights to provide overwatch for the Marines in the area. The fact that the place had so many windows meant better security for us because the Moosh didn't know where to shoot. We spent a day in the hospital, and Chris and Tony ended up getting one kill each. The Marines had assaulted the area in force and met much less resistance than they had expected. The next night, we left the same way we'd come. We opened the wrought iron gate and headed toward the same road we'd crossed the night before. At the road, we set up security and moved tactically across. The road was on a berm that crested about 10 feet above the hospital side and field to the north, and there was soft dirt on both shoulders. We set security on the near and far side, and the platoon moved across. Biggles and Tony picked up rear security, and as they began to cross, an army unit shot at them. The soldiers had been holding security on the area and mistook Biggles for Moosh. He took cover, and we turned on our IFF markers, identity friend foe, to signal that we were friendly, and could you please stop trying to kill us? "Why the fuck are you shooting at us?" Rex barked into the radio at the army unit. I couldn't hear the response, but I have to assume it was something like, "Whoops, sorry." Thank God for poor marksmanship, I guess. We made our way back to the Cirque boat pickup, skipping the 18-foot wall, then to Hurricane Point, and back to base. On the ride back to Shark Base, we were all pretty tired, but Johnny looked like somebody had shit in his MRE. "Hey, Johnny, are you going to head out to the range anytime soon?" Biggles asked. "Why?" Johnny said. "I was thinking you might help a lowly pig gunner like me get better at shooting an M4, Biggles said. "Carlos Hatchcock couldn't help you, Biggles," Johnny said. "Maybe help me with my medic skills," I said. "Dumb Pollock," Johnny retorted. I joined in Biggles' laughter as we rumbled on in back of Big Zev. I thought about Bernie and his wicked wheelbarrow of IED tricks. I looked to my left and heard Biff ragging Johnny about how bad he was at video games. Mark was smiling as he watched the banter. I was smiling too. War can be terrible, but it has its moments. "I promise you, Johnny," EOD Nick said above the hum of the diesel and groan of tires on the asphalt, "I'll drive the water taxi the next time we invade Vietnam." We all laughed. Even Johnny managed a chuckle. Many people hear about the Battle of Ramadi, about what we did there and the things that happened, and tell me they're sorry. Their apologies, though well-intentioned, normally make me angry. The summer I spent in Ramadi was the watershed of my young adult life. What most people don't understand is that I would give back that summer in Harrisonburg in a heartbeat, but it's never occurred to me to wish I hadn't gone to Ramadi. Cop Falcon, South Central Ramadi, July 2006. After having a lot of success north of Route Michigan, the Army wanted to push farther into South Central Ramadi to establish a command observation post from which coalition forces could launch operations and further secure the district. The location the Army commanders chose for Cop Falcon, as it would come to be known, was a compound at the corner of Sunset and Baseline Roads. Sunset runs north-south, about a half mile east of the Habaniya Canal, and Baseline runs east from Sunset toward the Malab District in Ramadi Southeast. our platoon was tasked as the main reconnaissance element for the Army's operation to secure Falcon. Our objective's proximity to the canal afforded another opportunity for a riverine insertion. We started the op around 2000, trucking to Camp Hurricane Point under the cover of darkness to meet up with the Marine Circ boat unit again. This was one of our few ops with no Jundees, and as the Marines nosed their boats into the water, our 16-man platoon piled in and packed it up tight. I took up a position with my MK-11 toward the front of the boat. I had the suppressor elastic banded to my web gear to cut down on the length and weight of the gun. I slung one arm out of my ruck, sitting in a half crouch and pointing my gun out at the bank. Mark sat up next to me with his MK-48. He swatted at a mosquito on his neck. "I really need to remember to bring bug juice for these riverine ops," he said. "It doesn't really help," I said. "These mosquitoes don't give a fuck. They're going to get theirs." I swatted at one buzzing next to my ear. I packed a dip of Copenhagen as the boats rumbled to life and headed west on the Euphrates. We made the turn south down the canal and then passed under the bridge that extends Route Michigan into the city. The slow rumble of the engine cut the water smoothly as I watched the sleeping city pass grainy green in my night vision. Our guns were equipped with advanced target pointer illuminator aiming lasers, AT-piles, and they projected infrared lines of glowing green that danced around on the horizon. Circ boats are armed with two miniguns, one on each side, and a 50 cal on the back. Miniguns are six-barreled rotary machine guns and a pretty mean piece of ordnance. Our pace was just slow enough that the wind cutting past us provided no noticeable relief from the mid-July heat and sauna-like humidity. I spat toward the water and watched a line of dips spitfall on the boat's wall in front of me. The sceneries changed from small buildings to reeds and palms, and finally to the structures that indicated we were entering the belly of the city. I rechecked the safety on my weapon. We approached our insertion point in the city's south-central region, rumbling up toward a grove of trees and low grass. We hit the bank and exited quickly, fanning out and setting security. After a quick pause, we got into a single-column formation and moved out. Chris was on point with Biggles next in line, then Luke, Rex, me, and Mark. We moved slowly and stealthily, applying the same maxim we used while clearing buildings. Slow is smooth. Smooth is fast. We were in no rush to get there. No one is a fan of running to his death. As we patrolled through the trees, I strained to see the shadows, anticipating the Mooj, who might be waiting to light us up. We reached an intersection and Chris gave the signal to halt. We took a knee and set security before moving across and into the city's ravaged streets. Chris passed back the signal to break into a dual-column formation. This provided cross-cover with each column watching its opposing rooftops. After a couple of blocks, the streets narrowed, and Chris signaled for us to funnel back to a single column. Suddenly, the smell of human shit smashed me in the face like a frying pan. About 50 yards in front of us was a canal of raw sewage, Shit Creek. On one deployment, a SEAL buddy of mine actually fell into one of Iraq's shit creeks and was submerged in raw sewage for a few seconds. He became violently ill for several days. Internally, I cursed the engineers who had conjured up the shit creeks. When the signal came back to freeze, everyone silently took a knee. Several seconds passed, and then three shots rang out from the front of the platoon. Then, the signal came to move out with quickness. We ran, and I saw the first few guys make their way across the flimsy 2x6 that served as the Shit Creek's walking bridge. I rushed across carefully. Up ahead, Chris put three security rounds in a body laid out on the ground just off our path. He was already dead, but since there was an AK next to him, the legend was just making sure. As I ran past, I looked down and saw a skinny Mooj in a blue tracksuit and tank top with a red and white wrap around his neck. His face had been mostly blown off, but I caught the sight of a giant pair of horse teeth, which I assumed were his front incisors. I could count at least three shots right to the eye-nose triangle. An AK-47 lay on the ground next to him. Apparently, he was waiting to ambush another patrol as we approached. He had picked the wrong spot and the wrong time, to say the least. Our target building was only about 100 yards up, and I could see the 8-foot wall surrounding it as we approached the corner of Sunset and Baseline. We peeled left and right, stacking up on the wall to hold security, while the rest of the platoon got in position. Mark and I hoisted Chris and Biggles up and over, and they unlocked the large main gate, which was big enough for a car to drive through. We flooded inside, and Mark and I cleared to the left side of the building. It was about 20 feet wide and 60 deep. We busted through the front door and into an airy and empty front room. Our train swept through the building while a few guys cleared the half acre around the outside. Empty and clear, we all took a breath. Those of us in the assault element headed to the rooftop to set up. We were all curious about what had gone down with the dead Muj on our approach.
"Chris, what happened, man?" Johnny asked quietly. "Did you get a fucking another one?"
"Hell no," he said in his Texas twang. "I saw the guy creeping, but my fucking at pile shit the bed on me. Luke comes up, I'm like, 'Give me a battery.' He's like, 'No,' and then he shot the dude."
"Give me a fucking battery," I said condescendingly, "in the middle of an op? Shit should have been squared away before we took off, man."
"Even the legend has to PMS his gear, brother. Guess you let that one slip away."
"Well, how many motherfuckers you killed?" he said defensively.
"Besides, you gotta let Luke get one once in a while. Officers need all the help they can get."
"Sounds like something the myth would say," I shot back.
"Yeah, yeah, I got your myth here. By the way, Dauber, no more Copenhagen for you," Chris said.
"I guess you're right, legend. I need to cut back. Don't want my grill looking like that horse-teeth motherfucker you shot back there," I quietly quipped.
Chris smiled. "Fucking Dauber, always some smart-ass shit to say."
"I love you too, legend," I replied.
From the top of the building, we could see clearly in every direction. The army, with the recommendation from our recce patrol a few nights before, had specifically chosen the building for that reason. It was optimally located in that part of the city. I set up, looking up Baseline Road to the north, and attached the suppressor to my MK-11. Chris set up facing east down Baseline with his 30 cal, and within a matter of minutes, that lucky bastard shot a Muj, placing an IED at 400 yards.
"Motherfucker," I mumbled to myself.
"Looks like you put some batteries in that weapon system," I said quietly.
"Yup," Chris said. "I think I got Horse T's buddy."
We both enjoyed a laugh. With our building secured and the surrounding area covered by SEAL snipers, it was time to call in the cavalry. Around midnight, the Army's main assault element rumbled down Sunset. At least 30 or 40 tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles were rolling in force to establish a permanent presence around the newly christened Cop Falcon compound. Things were about to get very boring. The Army's tanks and Bradleys surrounded the compound, locking down Baseline, Sunset, Schitt Creek to the west, and the area to our south. We were suddenly smack in the middle of a highly protected security perimeter with nothing to do but sit there, sweating. Knowing we weren't going to get much action if we stayed put, Luke got on the horn with the Army to try to find us some work.
"Good luck finding targets with an entire armored division down there," I said to Chris and Johnny.
"It's going to take Luke a while to finish tickling the Army officer's balls. It's time for some rack ops."
"Maybe he could borrow some batteries from the legend to power his radio and make the call," EOD Nick added.
Chris kept his eyes on his scope, clearly unamused by our banter. By the time I woke up from a power nap, we had gotten the go-ahead to press forward and set up in another building outside Cop Falcon's perimeter. Tony got everyone together and briefed the plan. Chris had identified a four-story apartment complex perfect for sniping, about 400 meters east of Baseline. We were going to patrol up, secure it, and set up sniper hides and kill any Muj trying to ambush the cop. Another day at the office. We patrolled out in a single column. At the edge of the Army's security perimeter, two tanks sat at an intersection, engines rumbling and guns trained to the north and east. The tank commanders' heads poked out from the top hatches like turtles from their shells. The Army's Abrams tanks used a weird type of fuel, and as we walked between them, I inhaled a hot blast of tank exhaust. It felt like Ramadi blowing a disgusting burp in my face. An angry breath from the rotted guts of a diseased city. We walked along crumbling sidewalks in the shadow of war-scarred buildings, and Baseline stretched before us into the distant blackness of the Malab to the east. At the target building, those of us not in the assault team fanned out in a hasty security perimeter while the breachers moved into place. They quietly cut a lock on the compound's gate and assaulted in. The rest of us peeled off in trail. There were at least 10 rooms on each floor, and we cleared the whole place quietly, calling our status over the radio as we progressed through. The building was completely abandoned, save the occasional prayer rug, bedding, and trash. Once again, I headed up to the roof with the other snipers. With the cover of darkness, we could stand up and get a good look over the wall around the rooftop at the real estate before us. Chris and I found a spot looking east that provided an unobstructed view of J Street for more than a kilometer. Chucky came up and blew two loophole charges in the wall on the east side and one on the south. Chris and I set up behind one of the hulls looking east. EOD Justin set up with an MK-48 on the hull to our right. Johnny set up looking south, and Mark, Spaz, and Ralphie set up watching the north. With Cop Falcon behind us to the west, our 6 o'clock was well covered. By 7 in the morning, I had begun to develop a gnarly case of swamp ass. Mark had come by a few minutes before, and the reading on his Sunto watch said 119 degrees. Some people will tell you that desert heat is dry heat. My ass on that 4-story building would tell you those people are full of shit. Despite the heat, I had a view of about 1,200 meters in which to engage, and I was feeling pretty good about our position. Chris and I had set up a wood pallet to perch on and added some prayer rugs for support. I had a poncho liner strung overhead to block the sun and provide some protection for my Polack skin. Being in the middle of Indian country, I expected to get the jump on some unsuspecting Mooj. I was ready for some work. The morning call to prayer sounded angry. It took me back to SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape School, where I sat caged up in a box, listening to similar music, looking forward to being in this position. The street was a normal beehive of activity, but I'd seen nothing of interest since the sun breached the horizon. My focus hadn't flinched since I lased my reference points, checked my dope card, and packed a chaw. Behind the gun, a focused mind equals success. Boredom is the main cause of missed opportunity. Like in deer hunting, any subtle movement on my part might catch my prey's eye. My pull of Copenhagen spit began to threaten my prayer rug, but I ignored it. I remained fixed, scanning the street from near to far. Then I saw him. He was only 200 yards away, and my scope provided a crystal clear view. A middle-aged man with short, graying black hair, a widow's peak, and a thin beard walked out of his compound and locked the gate behind him. A crude satchel sagged awkwardly over his brown man dress as he ambled my way. "You got him, Dauber?" Chris asked. I grunted an assent. He slid the satchel around to his front. The clear imprint of a 155mm artillery round was unmistakable as I repositioned the cheek weld on my MK-11. I felt the epinephrine pump through my arteries and hit the receptor sites like a freight train. Ride the lightning. Whether it's your first, third, or 17th kill, the excitement never fades. I controlled my breathing. The external temperature seemed to climb with my heart rate as he approached a hull in the middle of the road, about 120 yards in front of me. The reticle began to settle as he crouched at the hull, pulled the IED out of the satchel, and dropped it in the hull. As a professional warrior, a steward of the American flag, you operate under a strict set of guidelines. My rules of engagement were clear. Hostile action or hostile intent were the behaviors for which I could kill an insurgent. The presentation of the artillery round left no doubt. I felt the switch as my breathing deepened and my heart slowed even more. I felt every muscle in my body relax as I tightened the slack in the match-grade trigger of my MK-11. The Mooj stood looking up in my direction, and from behind a pair of binoculars, Chris said, "Dump him." I hit my respiratory pause as the hammer dropping caught me by surprise. The bullet barked out of the rifle at 2,900 feet per second, tearing through the man's solar plexus. The kick from a suppressed MK-11 is virtually non-existent, so my reticle never left the target. Snipers often talk about seeing the pink mist when they shoot someone. Pink mist is the spray of blood and matter exiting your target when your round impacts. This shot was definitely a pink mist moment. I saw everything. His body buckled violently like a bear trap slamming shut. It looked almost like he kissed his toes before going down hard in a heap. I felt my senses go into overdrive as the adrenaline began to fire through my arteries again, and I immediately scanned for more targets. It was an easy shot. A blind man could have made it using a toilet paper roll as a scope. Regardless, it was a good kill and a great way to start our day on 4-story. It was a testament to our tactics and our ability to predict the enemy's response to our huge incursion into their territory. Knowing they couldn't mount a serious attack against Cop Falcon's perimeter and a bunch of tanks and Bradleys, The Mouche settled for mining the areas just outside the cop's perimeter and trying to prevent the army from pressing deeper into the district. The Mouche expected to see new American patrols pushing through the streets very soon. They were on a mission to mine the roads as much as possible, so stifling those efforts was pure satisfaction as a sniper. Each guy that I killed lessened the probability that an American soldier would be killed or maimed on patrol. I've seen the carnage from a 155mm round that finds an American patrol. Preventing that outcome was incredibly rewarding. Knowing you're literally protecting somebody else in that way is a feeling unmatched by any other. Chris's Texas drawl snapped me out of the zone. Why didn't you keyhole his eye? In my head, I said, are you fucking kidding me? The guy's dead. I just killed a terrorist. It doesn't matter where I shot him. He's fucking dead. In reality, my grin flattened a little. What else could I expect from the legend? Any other person making that comment would have drawn a snarky response from my 24-year-old invincible ass, but Chris's acumen as a sniper was well established. I took his comment as a reminder not to get cocky. My rationale had been that center mass was less risky than a headshot, but Chris's words reminded me that there's always a tougher shot and there would be plenty more opportunities to take them. I watched the Mouge's buddies as they threw ropes out from behind a wall, trying to get the dead man to grab on. Finally, they came out with a white flag and collected up the body. This exchange always killed me. They're collecting a Mouge, but they're Mouge too. Because they have a white flag and no weapons, I have to watch through my scope and let them live. I have to do this, knowing that they would not extend the same courtesy. Later, they will try to kill me. I will try to kill them first. I sat on the gun for about another hour. I felt good, and my mind wandered to thoughts of New Guy Glory. I have 3 kills behind the gun, more than any other new guy. I just smoked this dude on J Street. This is going to be a great hideout. At about 8 in the morning, I switched out with Chris on the gun and kicked back to take a nice rest and revel in the glory of my sweet kill. Chris was on the gun for about an hour before he shot a guy. When he shot the second one a few minutes later, I was lying on my back, sweating buckets. I told myself maybe Chris was somehow bullshitting me on the second one. I rolled over and grabbed the binoculars and watched Chris's sector for a while. After a few minutes, a Mouge with an AK-47 darted across the street at about 300 yards. Chris shot him effortlessly. Every time I heard Chris take another shot and kill a Mouge, I'd think, fuck, another one? Really? It's frustrating as a team guy, because your competitive edge kicks in and you want to know how anyone can be that lucky. You want to be the one on the gun. Do you have a fucking AK painted on your reticle or something, you lucky bastard? I asked sarcastically. Don't hate me because I'm beautiful, Dauber. I just shook my head and grabbed an empty water bottle to piss into. When I was done, I tightened the lid and set the bottle next to 2 others, noticing the distinct progression in color from dark yellow to even darker yellow to amber. It was easily more than 120 degrees, and it was time to check on the guys in my capacity as a medic. The piss bottle spectrum played out similarly at every position. Everybody looked beat down by the sun. These guys are so dehydrated right now, I thought. I told Luke we needed a water resupply if we were going to keep killing bodies on the rooftop. Luke selected Mark, me, and Biff for a hasty resupply mission. At around 11, we patrolled 400 meters back to the cop, leapfrogging the whole way. We eagerly pounded 2 bottles of water each before filling a 120-gallon white cooler with ice and water. Then the 4 of us ran back to 4th Story, heaving the awkward beast along through the streets, hoping speed would make up for our tactical disadvantage of being a patrol of only 4 and carrying a loaded ice chest through Ramadi in broad daylight. 2 of our boys waited at the door, and 2 more popped out to hold security as we fumbled up to the building, running inside and dumping the chest heavily on the ground. We smiled as we sat catching our breath for a moment. The guys who were not on watch started trickling downstairs to grab cold waters. I grabbed several and delivered them to some of my guys on the roof. I set a couple of bottles next to Chris. You get any more? I asked. A few, he said. I counted 10 total. 4 hours on the gun, and Chris had 10 kills. I had 1. Johnny had 1, too. I just shook my head. Well, get your ass out of the way. It's my turn. Chris and I had agreed to just leave his bolt-action 30 cal in place because switching out rifles was a hassle. We were about the same size, so our eye relief and shoulders matched up on the gun. From noon to 2, I didn't see much. I took a shot at a guy at around 800 meters and missed. The mid-afternoon heat was brutal, and I was frustrated, so I gave the gun to Chris a little after 2. He spent the next 3 hours behind the gun and shot at least 7 more moosh. Son of a bitch. You know I hate you, right? I said as Chris got up to switch out again.
I know, Dauber. I'd hate me too.
He sat up and slapped me on the shoulder.
Don't worry, son. Someday your balls will drop. Fucking team guys.
It was about 5 o'clock, and I was determined to find another target. I had to wait about an hour before a peeker obliged me. Peekers usually leave no doubt as to their hostile intent, but hostile intent is always more of an ethical hurdle for a sniper than clear-cut hostile action, like the behavior for which I'd killed the man placing the IED. When you watch a peeker, in the back of your mind you're thinking, if this isn't justified, I could really fuck myself. Every shot has to be a good target, so you never shoot until you're sure. A curious little kid looking around a building after hearing gunfire nearby looks very different from a military-age male between 16 and 50 trying to collect information. When somebody nervously creeps their eyes around a corner while talking into a cell phone, they're usually gathering and reporting information on American positions. Insurgents often use cell phones to coordinate attacks, so seeing peekers with phones always made us especially cautious. If someone was gathering intel on our position, we could shoot them. Those were our rules of engagement. The first peek around a corner is a try. A second peek confirms, and a third peek gets a round in the face. At 400 meters out, I could see into a small courtyard with a couple of bushes and some pillars on the front porch of a house. Behind the pillars, a bearded, black-haired man dressed in the standard Mouge attire of Adidas track pants and t-shirt was looking around one of the pillars with a cell phone pressed to his ear. I saw him look up in our direction, thinking we couldn't see him. He pulled back behind the pillar for a moment, then looked out again, still talking into the cell phone held to his ear. I thought, he's either calling in our position to a mortar team, or he's working with another group to pull off a coordinated attack. He disappeared momentarily and then looked out one last time, cocking his head and stretching his neck while holding the phone away from his ear. I settled my crosshairs just a little high at the top of his head, accounting for the 100-meter difference between my scope's elevation setting, 300 meters, and the actual distance, 400 meters. Then I hit him. The round tore through his right cheekbone and practically took his face off. I didn't see him fall because the kick from the 30 cal knocked my sight picture off, but I quickly tracked back on him in time to watch him buckle and fall on the sidewalk. Justin was looking out with binoculars through the loophole to my right. "Can I get a witness from the congregation, Justin?" I said to Justin. I didn't want to wake Chris. He hadn't slept since we landed to start our foot patrol to Cop Falcon. "Yeah, I got him," he replied. "He's fucking dead on the sidewalk. I think he looks better with that facelift you gave him." I cycled the bolt on the gun. I picked up the brass and put it in my pocket with the shell casing from the layup shot earlier. Easy money. I was feeling good again, and I went back to scanning for targets. We spent the entire day on that rooftop dealing death. When we finally packed up to leave, Chris, Johnny, and I had racked up 23 kills.
Battle is the most magnificent competition in which a human being can indulge. It brings out all that is best. It removes all that is base. Duty is the essence of manhood.
I thought about the quote from General Patton as I continued to scan the street for the rest of the evening. Whether the legend thought my nuts had dropped or not was the least of my worries. I was in combat, and that's all that mattered to me. I thought about the poor sons of bitches back in their college dorms, playing video games about the stuff we were doing on a daily basis. College felt like a lifetime ago, and I wasn't looking back. I was feeling extremely satisfied as we patrolled back to Cop Falcon in the dark that night. Soldiers and vehicles distributed HESCO and Jersey barriers around the perimeter of the burgeoning COP as we approached. And about a block away from our main entry point, a wrecker truck was hooking up a mangled MRAP, still smoking from the IED blast that had chewed up its entire front end. The troop compartment with its V-shaped hull had worked like it was supposed to and deflected the blast away, protecting the soldiers inside. Nevertheless, the sight put a damper on the high I was feeling after a windfall day. I really did not want to die from an IED blast. One bad day is all it takes. When we walked inside the building we'd secured the night before, the Army was filling sandbags, the most basic defense we had against blasts. I gave Mark and Biggles a what-the-fuck look. we dropped our rucks and started moving sandbags upstairs. War never sleeps. Chris packed to Copenhagen, sent some my way, and took the first shift on the gun. Then I took the 2-6 block. With the exception of the time that Luke lit up horse teeth on the assault cop Falcon, the nighttime hours were usually uneventful. At those times, Copenhagen chewing became incessant. I wiped my dip-stained fingers in my eyes to chase the sleep away. I strained into the darkness, hoping some moosh made their way across my view. Unfortunately, a few cur dogs and feral cats were the only ones who patrolled the garbage-riddled streets that night. I gave the gun back to Chris at 6 and tried to get some sleep. The call to prayer droned in the distance as I struggled to fall asleep. I picked up my loopholed binoculars and watched as the morning sun breathed life into the streets again.
800 meters, Chris said.
What?
That's where I'm watching. 800 meters. That's where you see the most activity right now, isn't it?
I brought the binos back up. There was no doubt. The busiest part of the street was 800 meters out.
Yeah, you're right, I said. No shit. This ain't my first rodeo, you know.
I stayed on the binos, hoping to suck up all the trade secrets the legend was willing to give out.
2 guys on a moped. You see them, he said. Looks like they're carrying something.
I found them in my binos. 2 military-age males in standard tracksuit and sandals, moosh attire, riding a moped. Just a second after I located them, I saw the passenger drop something in a hole in the road and then drive on without missing a beat.
You see that? Chris asked.
Yeah, dude on the back dropped something in a hole, I said.
Yeah, backpack. I'm going to shoot him.
Chris and I tracked the moped for several hundred meters, waiting patiently as they meandered between parked cars and pedestrians, slowly closing the distance between themselves and death. I sat watching through binos, waiting for the hammer to fall. Sniping is a voyeuristic practice. You always know the person you're about to kill has no idea it's coming. You're watching them up close, and then you drop the hammer before they ever know what hit them. These guys were thinking they just had a highly successful bomb-laying mission and were probably feeling pretty good about themselves. In my mind, they were a train wreck in slow motion. They grew bigger and bigger in my binos. 700 meters, 600, 500, 400. At 200 meters, I heard Chris say, "All right," before taking a deep breath and then the crack from his 30 cal. The moped was a mere 150 yards out when I saw the pink mist explode from around the two men. A perfect center mass shot. The driver's head dropped lifeless like a rag doll, and his hands fell from the handlebars. The moped started wiggling out of control, and I could see that the second guy wasn't moving at all. No diving for cover or jumping off the bike. He just piled up on top of the driver, obviously lifeless too. The wiggling moped crashed into a small wall and fell over. Neither passenger moved, and a pool of blood started forming on the ground around them.
"Good kill," I said from behind the binos. I put the binos down and looked at Chris.
"Dude, that was fucking awesome. You just smoked 2 dudes with 1 bullet.
"Yeah, I guess the taxpayer got his money's worth with that one," Chris said, smiling, eyes still on the scope. 2 birds, 1 badass piece of American lead.
2 more for the legend.
What are you at now? Like 60? 70?
Something like that.
Better watch out. If you fart too hard, them lucky horseshoes will fall out.
Nice shooting.
"Yeah, that was a good one," Chris replied.
"I guess that makes up for Ralphie's miss," I said.
"He sure killed that PowerPoint presentation for this op, though,"
the legend said with a chuckle as he resumed his scan. About a block over from the moped crash, a Marine patrol had a clear line of sight to the intersection where the moosh went down. They'd heard the shot, and from their perspective, all they saw was this moped with 2 dead guys wiggling out of control and crashing into a wall. They had no context of the hostile action we'd witnessed when the moosh dropped a bomb in a hole 800 meters out and casually drove on. The Marines knew our location, but didn't have a line of sight to our building. Luke came up to our room to get the usual report after a kill. Whenever one of our snipers shot somebody, our OIC or chief would take a report and annotate the details, ensuring all our shots were justified under the rules of engagement. We had to document the shots we took, filling out shooter statements after every engagement where hostile force was used. These documents involved the time, location, caliber of rifle, what the enemy action was at the time of the shot, and general atmospherics. Early on in our deployment, whenever a sniper would shoot somebody, other team guys would come to the room or roof wanting to know what went down. By this time in the deployment, we'd been smoke-checking so many guys that a bad guy getting dumped just became commonplace. The only people who still came asking for the story were those who were duty-bound to do so. I felt a strong urge to tell everybody in the platoon about the awesomeness I'd just witnessed.
"What do you got?" Luke asked. "I shot two guys on a moped. Killed them both with one bullet. The passenger dropped an IED in a crater at 800 meters. Dauber saw the whole thing."
"Roger that, Luke," I said.
"Roger that," he responded.
While Luke took his report, Rex's radio came alive downstairs in the house with chatter from the Marines asking for an explanation.
"Why did these two dead guys just coast into a wall? They don't have any weapons on them. They weren't doing anything outside our ROEs."
Luke explained the situation to the Marines, but they insisted on sending a patrol to inspect the hull. Chris and I weren't in the loop for all this. We didn't expect anyone to doubt what we had seen and question the validity of the shot. With our sniper overwatches, we had thwarted coordinated attacks on Marine patrols on many occasions. In this instance, we were being proactive. We had just stopped an IED before a Marine patrol drove over it. Chris and I kept scanning the road for a potential counterattack. The Muj were sneaky. The going rate Al-Qaeda was paying for digging an IED crater in Ramadi was $200. Dropping an IED into a hull earned twice as much. The IED business in Ramadi was literally booming. For dirt-poor Iraqis, freelancing as IED droppers often meant the ability to buy food or add a few more goats and chickens to their flock. The Muj were clever enough to drop the IEDs, throw fishing line across the street to drag the pressure pads into place, and then fake a broken-down vehicle so someone could connect the device in 20 seconds or less. To the untrained observer, it was easy to miss the nefarious nature of this behavior. But we were dialed into the enemy's tactics. Anytime you're hunting the enemy, you have to think like them. And we team guys had gotten exceedingly good at this. After Chris dumped the duo, the street where they dropped the IED buzzed with activity. The foot and vehicle traffic around the site obscured our view, and we were unable to maintain a constant visual on the IED crater. I'm sure some aspiring capitalist picked up the IED and took it home so he could fight another day. When we got word the Marines were sending a patrol, we focused up on the area where the Muj had dropped the IED. The road was flooded with activity, and we watched three Humvees approach the hull 800 meters out. They set up a security perimeter and inspected the hull. Unsurprisingly, there was nothing in it. Chris and I knew what we saw, and we saw the passenger on the Muj moped drop a bomb in that hull. The lack of evidence was a sticky point, and it caused some friction between the Marines and our leadership. There was an investigation, and the Judge Advocate General, JAG, paid Chris some special attention. Fortunately, my shooter statement corroborated the fact that lethal force was justified, and that was the end of it. Everyone in the platoon was irritated by the lack of trust. We weren't in the business of killing innocents, and as professional soldiers, we were very surgical with our use of force. For us new guys, this event marked a baptism into the politics of war. There is a stark dichotomy between special operations and the rear echelon motherfuckers, REMFs. From a purely statistical standpoint, the REMFs thought we were operating with carte blanche. To them, shooting two guys on a moped probably seemed too incredible, but the hostile action the Muj had committed was undeniable. The REMFs would try to make life difficult for us. But to the Marine grunts and Army ground pounders I chewed Copenhagen with in sniper hides and cops, we were putting the fear of God into the enemy. That was the only validation I needed. One team, one fight. We knew what was at stake if our actions caused the deaths of innocent civilians. The media would crucify us, and Leavenworth would become home. Winning the hearts and minds of the local populace was an important part of the overall mission in Ramadi. And you can't win hearts and minds if you can't protect the innocent while you kill the bad guys. Truthfully, the threats of the media and Leavenworth were not what kept me honest behind the gun. I wanted to kill bad men. I did not want to kill innocent ones. The investigation pissed me off. I knew what the fog of war was, what the risks were when I pulled the slack from the trigger. I also knew that not every American who had ever donned the uniform deserved to. I knew about Haditha and May Lai, about atrocities committed as far back as Atlanta in 1864. I also knew my personal motive for being there was for killing terrorists, period. So though I understood somebody might see a shot or engagement from a different perspective, it didn't take the sting out of their questioning our actions or integrity. Fortunately, the more dead moos you stack up like cordwood, the more conventional troops on the ground appreciate it and help protect you from the bullshit. To those of us in the mix, the struggle was constant and creeping death was a heartbeat away. 24 hours later, I watched the ink dry on my shooter statement in the platoon hut at Shark Base. I reread my words, making sure not to omit any pertinent details. The devil is in the details. In this case, two moos dropping an IED with the intent to kill Americans and coalition forces. Two military-age males carrying an IED device on a moped. IED crater. Effectively engaged with 30 cal. Targets eliminated. My shooter statement corroborated the fact that lethal force was justified. And that was the end of it. I had signed statements prior to this, and there would be more to come. The Battle of Ramadi was hitting the fever pitch of summer. I thought about the legend's poise when he engaged the Easy Riders. The man was a machine. In sniping, there are minor details that can determine whether there is success or total failure. Any clown can pull a trigger on a range, but a vigilant eye and a clear mindset are necessities on the battlefield. Robert Heinlein said, "There are no dangerous weapons, only dangerous men." For a few months now, we'd been meeting Ramadi's most dangerous men, and we hammered them as if the desert city were the anvil on which we struck. I stood up, my shooter statement in one hand, as I slung my rifle over my shoulder. I needed to head back to my tent and recharge, but I was feeling hungry. Only not for food. I let the weight of the weapon on my side comfort me. It was a gnawing that grew daily in the desert, quenched only by the squeeze of the trigger and the blood of the enemy. I took a deep breath and headed out into the bright Iraqi sunlight. Maybe hungry is the wrong word, I thought. I nodded to myself, trudging through the moon dust toward my tent. Dangerous, I thought. I feel dangerous.